So hopefully everybody will come back. I'll see your faces. Well, welcome everybody. I haven't been around for a while. I missed all of December because I was away. So it's good to be back, and it's good to see all of you. As always, I love that we co-create this like spiritual space that's nourishing to our practice, and that we meet every week in such a supportive way. So really a blessing. So this morning I'm going to dedicate this teaching to my dad of blessed memory, whose yahrzeit is actually on Shabbat. It's rare that it falls on Shabbat, but it's on Shabbat. So I'm dedicating this teaching to him. So the title of this week's Torah portion is Vayechi, which translates as "And he lived." We read about Jacob's final years in Egypt, where he's reunited with his beloved Joseph, sees and blesses his grandsons Ephraim and Manasseh. And this is the only scene in the Torah where a grandfather actually blesses a grandchild. And then on his deathbed, Jacob blesses each of his 12 sons. And he blesses them in a way that they're not just like mere well wishes, like, "I wish you a great life and you should have all these riches and, and successes." He actually, there's some sort of like prophetic character assessment that sort of defines the future and sort of helps his sons sort of like tackle their like core character and whatever they have to like overcome or actually develop more of. So his blessings are very interesting if you read all of them. And he insists on being buried in the promised land. So Jacob dies, and it describes as being, his death is described as being gathered into his people, which is a beautiful description of dying, like being gathered into your people, into people in the present, people in the past, his ancestors. And after Jacob's death, Joseph, with Pharaoh's permission, led a large honorable procession, including Egyptian officials, to the promised land to fulfill his father's request. Jacob was buried in the cave of Machpelah, the burial place of Abraham and Sarah, his grandparents, Isaac and Rebekah, his parents, and his first wife, Leah. And Joseph forgives his brothers a second time. And he himself dies, having assured his brother that God will eventually bring the family back to the promised land. The reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers puts a stop to a generational cycle of sibling rivalry and revenge, and which we witness throughout all of Bereshit. I mean, all of Genesis and Bereshit. And Joseph also insisted on being buried in Canaan and asked that his bones be carried to the promised land for burial, knowing that people would be in Egypt for a long, long time. So the book of Genesis is sort of a narrative of all these conflicts within the family, but it comes to a serene end and a new period of hardship leading to the birth of Israel as a nation, which is about to begin their new journey in the next book of the Torah. So the Parsha teaches us about legacy, forgiveness, faith, finding holiness in any given situation, maintaining ideals despite adversity, and bridging the patriarchal narratives to the Exodus by emphasizing the family's connection to Israel and their divine mission. Key themes include Jacob finding true life in his family's adherence to faith, the power of prayer for the seemingly impossible, and the ongoing journey of blessing and refining faith. The Parsha illustrates that true prayer evokes asking God for the seemingly impossible and transcending human limitations and partnering with the divine to repair the world. So for me, this Parsha brings to the foreground four main ideas or thoughts. One is ancestors and our parents. Two is the strength of faith and being true to oneself no matter where you are. Three is forgiveness, and four is impermanence. Thich Nhat Hanh taught that we are not separate from our ancestors, but rather their continuation. We are a continuation of our ancestors. I sort of love this quote. It's sort of like timeless, like everything that's from the past we bring to the present, that there's this continuous like flow of who we are. Jonathan Sacks writes, Joseph was saying to his brothers, by your repentance, you have written a new chapter in the story of which you are a part. The harm you intended to me ultimately led to good. So long as you stayed, the people prepared to sell a brother into slavery. None of that good could be attributed to you, but now you have transformed yourself through tshuvas, so have transformed the story of your life as well. By your change of heart, you have earned the right to be included in a narrative whose ultimate outcome was benign. We cannot change the past, but we can change the story people tell about the past. But that only happens when we ourselves change. He goes on to say, we can only change the world if we can change ourselves. That's why the book of Genesis ends with the story of Joseph and his brothers. It tells on an individual level the story that the book of Exodus tells on a national level. Israel is charged with the task of transforming the moral vision of mankind, but it can only do so if individual Jews, of whom the forerunners were Jacob's children, are capable of changing themselves. What we become depends on our choices, and we are often free to choose this way or that. But what we become shapes the story of our life. And only in hindsight, looking back, do we see the past in context as part of the tale whose end we now know. If life is like a narrative, then later events change the significance of earlier ones. So when I ponder transformation and forgiveness, which is part of transformation, I envision impermanence and everything changing all the time. Every breath is a reminder of the nature of impermanence. Every inhale becomes an exhale. Every exhale gives birth to a new inhale. Each breath contains both the fullness of the inhale and the emptiness of the exhale. The inhale and the exhale are not separate. These are two aspects of one complete breath, here one moment and gone the next. Our practice enables us to experience impermanence as we pay attention to our breath and as we witness what arises and fades away in our meditation, be it thoughts, feelings, or sensations. As we become more attentive to our inner life, we come into harmony with ourselves and these arisings. And with our mindfulness meditation practice, we become less reactive and have the freedom to choose more appropriate responses for any given situation so that our responses are helpful, bringing blessings into the world. Robert Robin of the Charter for Compassion writes, understanding and accepting impermanence brings us closer to reality and opens us to a life of humility, a deep spiritual space accompanied by empathy and compassion. As humility and peace deepen within us, we stop fighting life's changes and accept the inevitability of an impermanence. we more easily accept the nature of existence. He goes on to say that the recognition of impermanence allows us to be open to the poignant beauty of each moment, and perhaps touch each task, each person, each living thing with love and appreciation. But it is this very poignancy that helps us to open to each other with love and compassion, because each moment may be the last moment. Our beloved meditation teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, says that change isn't just a fact of life we have to accept and work with. To feel the pain of impermanence and loss can be profoundly beautiful, can be a profoundly beautiful reminder of what it means to exist. Impermanence is not only loss, it is also change, and change can be refreshing and renewing. In fact, change is always both good and bad, because change, even when it's refreshing, always entails loss. Nothing new appears unless something old ceases. Time is impermanence, and impermanence is time. Time is change, development, and loss. Present time is ungraspable. As soon as it occurs, it immediately falls into the past. Nothing appears unless it appears in time. And whatever appears in time appears and vanishes at once. Time is existence, impermanence, change, loss, growth, and development, the best and the worst news at once. The great 12th century Japanese master Dzogchen calls this strange, immense process Buddha nature. The Buddha's final words express this: impermanence is inescapable, everything vanishes. Therefore, there is nothing more important than continuing the path with diligence. A Chinese Buddhist monk states that impermanence means change and movement. It applies to people, plants, trees, animals, and all things. It's not affected by power, and it does not discriminate. Because of its universal nature, impermanence has been proven as the truth or principle of all sentient and non-sentient things. And Pema Chodron says impermanence is a principle of harmony. When we don't struggle against it, we are in harmony with reality. And of course, one of my favorite teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, teaches, impermanence should be understood in the light of interbeing, because all things inter are. They are constantly influencing each other. It is said a butterfly's wings flapping on one side of the planet can affect the weather on the other side. Things cannot stay the same because they are influenced by everything else, everything that is not itself. The whole cosmos has come together in order to help the flower manifest herself. The flower cannot be herself alone. The flower has to interbe with the sunshine, the cloud, and everything in the cosmos. Impermanence helps us develop sympathy, empathy, and compassion for them and ourselves, for all beings who are subject to the same terms of existence. There was another quote that I love from Thich Nhat Hanh, but I must have left it out. So Thich Nhat Hanh also says that to be alive is a miracle, and that mindfulness allows one to touch life in the present moment. And he says, he emphasizes transforming mud, which he calls suffering, into lotuses, peace and compassion, through deep listening and understanding. So I have a few questions to ponder and a poem to end this teaching. The questions are, how do we use our practice to sustain us in difficult times? How do we use our practice to help us be present in the ebb and flow of life and the people around us. Does a daily awareness of death inspire or help us to be present in the moment and live more fully? I read that a chaplain who deals with death all the time in a hospital was so depressed in his beginning years of dealing with death, and then became inspired and felt like he lived more fully after dealing with death on such a daily basis and for so long, that he felt more present, more alive, and living more fully. Does a daily, oh, I did that. How do we use mindfulness to stay true to our core beliefs and faith? And how does forgiveness empower us and free those we forgive? Free us and those we forgive. So let's take a moment of silence. And then we'll come back for Q&A, for discussion.